Hello, everyone, and welcome to Horrorspiria. My name is May, and I am so excited for today's episode because it's on a topic that is very personal for me, but we'll get into it. We have a special guest, which makes it even better. So without further ado, everyone, please welcome Amber.
Hi. Hi, May. Thank you so much for having me today. I'm so excited.
Yeah, totally. So Amber, we became like social media friends. We're in the same, like, I guess, like community or horror circle or whatever. I mean, that's the beauty of social media, right? Is that you sort of just like follow people. I've been following you for a while now and I love your reviews. You have such amazing reviews.
Thank you so
They're
much.
So detailed and like you do what every great reviewer should do is that it goes beyond the scope of the film while still being very much about the film. So I always love when you pop on up. But before I keep like gushing about you, why don't you tell people like in your own words, like, who are you? What do you do?
Well, basically just over a year ago, I realized that I had way too much horror movie knowledge and I had seen way too many and I was driving my friends crazy. I was like, have you seen this? Have you seen this? People were like, no, shut up. I don't want to talk about this with you. So my friend was like, you need an outlet. I was like, okay. So I started posting the pictures on Instagram. Like I just started posting screen grabs with like short little reviews, not really usually more than two or three sentences. And my quote unquote gimmick as I call it, which is every post I do like an FFO at the end. So if you like these three things, then you'll like this film. And I started to get, you know, make some great friends on there. And then I found as I watched more, I had more to say. So the reviews kept going. They kept getting bigger. And then I started to reach out to like horror publications like The Amazing Ghouls magazine, who I write reviews for, Necromancy magazine, Grimoire of Horror, and I do more long form reviews for them. Then I started the podcast in last October, I think it was, because again, I was just like, I just have more to say. I just need to like get it all out in the public. I am so happy to be part of this wonderful little community that May, you yourself are also a part of. I'm so happy to have met you and like all the other amazing people that we interact with. And yeah, it's just been an amazing year and a half, I think it is now.
I love that. You just really took it upon yourself because I've always been obsessed with horror too, but I never got the confidence to explore it weirdly, other than, you know, like watching everything that ever came out. But I never decided to wade in the waters until I got assigned the class. And now it's like, easy in the sense that we both really love it and we really love talking to other people about it. And my favorite thing is learning about different cultures and talking to an international community about it. Especially because, I mean, sorry, shade to everyone in my country, but sometimes the American horror community is like very classist in a way. Like it's like there are such clearly defined almost like political economy markers. But what I love about finding people on Instagram, things like that, is that, you know, we love aesthetic, but we love talking to each other, right? And so you know, now you have like this really awesome little horror publication, horror review thing going on. I think that that's inspiring.
Thank you so much. Yeah, you're totally right. Like one of the most amazing things about it, and you know, social media gets a bad rep, and rightfully so, because it's a cesspit a lot of the times. But getting to speak to people around the world, and that in turn opens up your eyes to so many viewpoints that you'd never thought of, and that in turn you can use that when you're watching horror movies, getting recommendations. It's just amazing. Love it.
Yeah, totally. So our topic for today was chosen by you, and I was so excited because I almost, like, you browsed my website and you were like, I see that you haven't done Japanese horror. Let's do Japanese horror. And I was like, yes. And the main reason why it's taken me so long is Japanese horror was the first, like, international cinema for me. Like, you know, The Ring came out when I was 8. And I was always like a studious little kid and I was like, oh my God, like where did this come from? And, you know, that led to Ringu and everything else. And so I grew up in a time where like when I was 8, 9, 10, the, like, there was no YouTube. There were no, like, video, like, internet was still really, it was a bit more established. What there was AsianHorrorMovies.com. And it was the only, like, it was, like, one of the very first streaming sites, like, ever, like, before the massive, you know, databases that people have now. Like, it was one of the few. And so, like, from ages like 11 to 14, I would come home. I wouldn't like, I never watched cartoons because I had AsianHorrorMovies.com.
I love that.
And so I watched, it started with Japan and then it bled into Korea. But Japanese horror cinema is like my gateway drug. And it's almost like too important in ways. And so I almost, that's why I almost like avoid it. Cause I'm like, I don't know, like, everyone has said so much. What can I say? But I sincerely appreciate you pushing me towards this because this is one of my absolute favorite topics. And it was my first love. So it's very sentimental for me.
Same. I'm so glad you said that. I can like hear and see the passion in your voice about J-horror. And I'm like so happy because same for me. Like I consider J-horror, and that's a broad term, which I'm sure we'll get into. But that's my favorite subgenre of horror. And kind of similar to yourself, I kind of got into it around like when I was growing as a person and being more aware of frightening things in the world. And yeah, just of all the countries who I love foreign horror, absolutely adore it. But of all the countries, Japan has always had like this grip on me. So I'm just so excited to get into this today.
Yeah, absolutely. What was the first one you ever saw?
Oh, I think like most people, it has to be Ring. It was quite a funny experience. I remember I went on holiday with my parents when I was very young, maybe the same age as yourself, or maybe let's say 10. And they had a bunch, my parents' friends had a bunch of like bootleg VHS tapes. And and I remember one of them was Ring, and I was definitely not old enough to be watching it. But I did.
Yeah, looking back, it's a lot, right?
Right? I did. And I really did not get that far through it. I never finished it at that age. And then the worst thing was where we were staying, we were on holiday at this very old farmhouse in France, which my mom and dad's friends were doing up. And there was a well in the garden. So that just like ruined me. Then after that, I didn't really come back to it until my late teens, just when I had gone to university, late teens, early 20s. I came back to it with Ju-on and One Miss Call, and went back to Ring and was like, oh, fuck, this is still terrifying.
Yeah, it holds up weirdly. I too, like you, since I saw it so young, I also had like a little bit of a reprisal, and I was like, was this as scary as I remember? And I just remember it being like just as good. And honestly, maybe unpopular opinion, American remake is just as good.
It's really good. It's one of the better American remakes. Usually I'm like, oh, they're like American remakes of foreign films.
No, yeah, totally same.
But it really stands up. And you mean, you know, it's got Naomi Watts in it, so it can't really fail. But yeah, no, it's terrifying.
It wasn't until I was doing research for this one that I didn't realize Hideo Nakata did The Ring 2.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I think he wanted like, he wanted his hand in it. I think that's a big part of why. Also why the American remakes of The Grudge kind of, well, the first one I enjoyed, the Sarah Michelle Gellar one, worked because the original director had a hand in it. And I think that definitely helps.
The Grudge is also such an interesting example because it didn't translate out of the country. Well, in the sense that they kept it in Japan, you know, but we had this American proxy, and it's such an interesting film when you look at it in the scope of all the other ones.
Yeah, it's, you know, nothing had ever been seen like this before in like, I don't like to use the term, quote unquote, Western society and Western horror. We had never seen anything like this before.
To get like to the core of it, you had a question earlier, or really you brought it up, like J-horror, like what does that even mean? So I guess let's go ahead and talk a little bit about that. J-horror, we typically use it to describe like the set of horror films coming out of Japan, particularly in the late 90s through the early 2000s. Yeah, that's like, okay, cool.
That's what they, yeah. I mean, Japanese horror and J horror, I think, are two different things. And yeah, you're right. Yes. I think J horror refers to that kind of late 90s boom of Ringu and Ju-on, etc.
To talk a little bit outside of the larger scope of Japanese horror, you know, Japan is in and of itself a very unique example for film history overall, because it was able to develop almost independently of the Western countries. Like, Western Europe and American film industries were very much like talking to each other, even though it was obviously, quote unquote, like a primitive time for filmmaking. And Japan follows some of the same trends, but like, Japan didn't get sound film until the 1930s, which was much later than the West. But the like really cool thing about that is that going to the movies became like more of this cultural participation. Like, they would do some of the like Westernish silent symphony sort of thing, but they typically like to perform their silent films via a benshi method, which is like a narrator, a pianist. It's almost like a storytelling form, like a literal play-ish almost storytelling form of cinema. But so while we have the early 30s in the UK, the US developing their early forms of, you know, horror films, and, you know, obviously the Germans and German expressionism, there isn't like this big, so to speak, movement of horror in Japan during this early time. But there are a lot of dramas and stories about ghosts, right? Like ghost culture and well, you know, like just the folklore of the Japanese people naturally blends into so much of their everyday life, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think I mean, like we mentioned before, I mentioned to you on Instagram, I lived in Japan for a couple of years, and I really am no expert at all, but from what little that I know, Japan is a country that really holds its superstitions like near and dear to its heart, and you know, ghost stories and ghost culture and beliefs that certain spirits or yokai or yure or things like that are very much real and very much a very important part of the film history, like you said.
It's this really interesting concept where there's a lot of skepticism over here. And it's, and you know, I think the Japanese people are very spiritual people. I'm not sure if I would use the word religious, so to speak. Like in America, I would say religious, but I think Japan, and that's like the difference, right? A lot of the Christian ideas, especially in American horror, are very like Christian oriented, very much tied to this idea of a soul. But in Japan, it's more like the dead are already walking among us. You know, like we interact with this in a daily life. It's not like this like separation more than in the West, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. You see that in films like Kuroneko, a film like that, where I suppose if you put it in like a Western context, the ghosts in it would be, it would be a big deal when they show up on the screen and the living person would be like, ooh, but they're very much like they interact as they're humans. The line between the two worlds is really very thin. And that's again, a huge part of Japanese spirituality is that thin membrane between living and dead. And that's why it's so important to keep the respect and contact with your ancestors up.
Yeah, which is where a lot of the anxiety or horror, so to speak, builds in a lot of these films, right? Typically, like when we talk about Japan's first horror film, what comes up is Onibaba from 1964, right? It's a feudal tale about a mother and her stepdaughter. Husbands are away at war and they're trying to make it work in rural Japan, and it's based on the Shin Buddhist tale of this mother with a mask that is trying to frighten her stepdaughter into staying with her, that way she doesn't run away with like some other man or something. And instead what happens is the mask gets stuck to the mother's face. You've seen Onibaba? Yeah,
I have a Hanya tattooed on my
Oh yeah. My god.
I mean, it's not the mask from Onibaba, but it's the same. It's a Hanya, so it's a mask from like traditional no and kabuki theater in Japan. I have I'm really due a rewatch of it, to be honest, but yeah, I have seen it. It's very just really quite terrifying and but very beautiful and very simple, I always think. And something that always, as you mentioned earlier, Japan's horror cinema history is a bit later than that of, you know, American. And films like Onibaba, often I think they look older. They feel older than they are. Like, you sometimes feel like you're watching this silent relic from the 20s. You're like, oh, no, this was only the 60s.
Yeah, no, it really was. And one thing that I don't think I pointed out earlier, and I do want to make a bit more explicit, is like this culture, the spirituality is very in tune in Japanese culture, but especially this notion of vengeance in the afterlife, right? Like vengeance is very much it's the underlying theme of almost every single Japanese film. And it especially pops up in Onibaba with this, it's a vengeful wartime story, right? And it comes at a really interesting time. So one thing I wanted to backtrack to mention is, Japan's film industry was like independently developing outside of the West. But like one thing is that World War I didn't really affect Japan the way that it affected the European industries and the way that it also boosted the American industry. And so I mentioned that because this is also around the time that Japan starts building a lot of its colonial power in Shanghai and in Korea, and they start colonizing those industries. And not a lot of these films have survived. I've tried to find them. Like I really want to see these Japanese interpretations of Korean cinema, of Shanghai cinema. But the reason why that's important is obviously World War II happens. A lot of stuff happens in World War II, right?
Yeah.
And then, but with the fall of World War II, the Allied powers move in, right? And so for about 5 years, there is this censorship board that is run by the Allied powers. And basically, they ban Japanese cinema from talking about nationalism, patriotism, suicide, slaughter, brutalism, basically everything that like could somewhat even relate to the war was like banned. But in 1950, the board was disbanded. And this is where we begin to get this quote unquote golden age of Japanese cinema. And yeah, Onibaba is considered like the first horror film, whatever that means. But we get a response to the war in a different kind of genre, right?
Yes. Yeah. I specifically always think about kaiju movies. Which were pretty, well, I'd say pretty big in Japan. They were absolutely huge in Japan and still are. So yeah, you get you get Godzilla, Mothra, King Ghidorah. And I always found it interesting that, you know, Japan was a country that was pretty much blown to smithereens by nuclear weapons at the end of World War II. And then, as you said, censorship for years. And then when we do get free reign, it's these stories of horrific mutations coming out of nuclear waste. And I always think if you compare that to the American nuclear waste or like, I don't know, in like American narratives, not just American, like quote unquote Western, again, it's always like the nuclear waste or makes a superhero or something comes out. It's like a kind of not good,
thing. Imperial.
But yeah. But then you get in Japan, they're like, no, we get giant mutated lizards coming out of the sea. And then you get a cultural icon like Godzilla, who is just, I love Godzilla so much.
So this is what happened. During COVID, obviously, I wasn't one that wanted to risk going to the movie theater. I waited until I was vaccinated. But in 2020, that is when all of these like drive-ins started popping up. I love a drive-in, and they're so rare. It's legit, like low-key for real, my dream to run a drive-in theater one day.
You should do it.
I trust. I'm not going to start a foundation and be like, nope. drive-in theater. Anyway, so there was one in Queens, New York, and I wanted to see my friend, and I was like, okay, I'll visit. And they were playing Godzilla, so I saw Godzilla, the ninth, obviously the original one.
That's so cool.
In a Queens drive-in, and it was just magical. It's like, that is how, like, you just get it, I feel, or at least we both get it, where it's like, it's so, you know, it's camp, but it's also so meaningful.
Yeah.
And Godzilla is going to come up in a big way when we talk more into the specifics of J-horror. But I mean, not to sound so obtuse, but she's just like an icon.
Yes.
She's just so iconic, you know?
All of them are. I love all of them. I mean, I love Mothra. I mean, I hated the new ones, but 2016, I think Hideaki Anno released a new Shin Godzilla, and that was so good as well. Like,
I haven't seen it.
It's really good. Okay. It's very much about like the political side, like the bureaucratic reluctance to get anything done that you know is quite poignant watching it from a post-COVID standpoint, to be honest.
This response to the war in Japan really comes across in these genre films, right? These genre monster films, and even of themselves, we had like monster-ish movies somewhat in the film realm before, but like it felt like the world changed after Godzilla globally, because it was like the monster film, and and that's when we get a lot of the exploitation films in America as well, and all the independent films. But what I was going to say is like the American response, especially to the war cinematically, was a lot of like war patriotism near like fictional documentaries, right? Because, you know, we had to espouse this war hero image afterward. I mean, of course, you also had like the code working in America, which did limit the gruesomeness, so to speak, that things like Godzilla could have really dug into. But I think it's really interesting that, again, Japan, this movement in Japanese filmmaking was going through a genre lens, through a very fantastical, but also very tethered to reality. People could immediately see the connection. It was not hidden, so to speak. And this ties into what, when we were talking about in Onibaba, because while Onibaba is based in folklore, and it's like it's folkloric in a sense, the mask was also very symbolic of the disfigurement of the bombing. So in these like very first Japanese horrors, we're really getting this response to something that, you know, was just traumatic, right? Yeah. Traumatic almost even seems like an understatement.
Yeah, I mean, I think arguably you can probably see the effects of the bomb in Japanese cinema today. I mean, I'm no expert, and I have not studied it, but I would not be surprised if, you know, it was still a very prevalent theme. You know, as I guess, like, we still see this like war hero image in films from the West today. It's very much,
it's awful. It's like a weekly thing. I tell my students, I'm like, do you guys know that the military helps fund Marvel films? Like, just need to put that in there.
Thank you. Oh my God. I was thinking, sidetrack. I always think it's funny when people like on Twitter are like, oh my God, Chinese cinema is just propaganda. I'm like, have you seen a Marvel film recently?
No, it's like, so bad. It's so bad. And they don't hide it. Do you know that the Walt Disney Company has a global security outreach team? And I'm like, what do you, and it's literally in the like job description. It's like ex-CIA employees or something like that. And I'm like, what do you guys think that's for?
Oh, I did not know that. Oh,
no, it's really bad. It's really bad. So inch along a little bit in this history so we can get to like the granddaddy, I guess. So we get these like little twists in atomic storytelling and genre that begins to you know, we get horror films coming out, but I think the next major one that comes after Onibaba is maybe my favorite, and it's Hasu,
which is so good.
Just like, it's so joyful.
That from start to finish, that film is just a laugh riot. I rewatched it not 2 days ago, actually, for this pod, and I was just like, this film is so good.
Yeah, like, there's not a wasted frame. And I remember the first time I watched it, I was like, I don't think I like it. And then I waited like a year, I rewatched it, and I'm like, this is the best movie ever. I think that's like the best feeling. Like, when you watch something for the first time, you're almost just so caught off guard. Yeah. You're like, what the fuck? Like, I also had that feeling when I watched The Happiness of the Categories.
I haven't seen that yet.
Oh my God.
It's been on my list for ages.
No, yeah. It's great, but it definitely was another one where I was like, huh? Like, okay. What? But I love that. So Hasu has a really interesting history. It all started because Toho, which is one of the biggest studios in Japan, saw that Jaws was blowing up in America, and they were like, hey, maybe make a version of Jaws, which was popular in Japan. Like, you know, these little weird knockoffs, which sometimes I always preferred the Japanese version. We don't really get a Jaws without
I would never have thought, oh yeah, this is Jaws. I mean, aside from the piano munching away on fingers, like, I would never think Jaws is in this film.
Yeah. So when he was given that direction, what he did is he sat down with his 13-year-old daughter.
Aww.
And he said he did so because kids see things in a way that, you know, when we become adults, we're learning like the language of adults and the language of social norms. But his daughter could just see things for what they were. Mm. And he said that if he were to try to have done something like Jaws, it would have had to come through this lens that he couldn't see through. So he sat down with his 13-year-old daughter. They had a long list of just things that happened. She was just like, she was just describing to him things that she would see in dreams.
So
and
cute.
That really is the basis of what happens in House Super, because it's just so random, right?
Oh, yeah.
And most of that is because of his amazing 13-year-old daughter's brain. He then hired a screenwriter, which based the general story on, actually, I think it's like an English folktale, but I'm not sure which one right off the top of my head. It's not a straight adaptation, but it was inspired by one. All of these inspirations don't even look anything close to whatever was first contracted for him to do. And I think that that's what makes Hasu so amazing.
Yeah.
And also another response to the war, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think something that always sticks out to me about Hasu is the overwhelming happiness that runs through this film. And I feel like you see this a lot in veins of Japanese culture. I'm thinking more like kawaii things, like this push to cutesiness,
totally.
don't think about anything bad, don't think about anything wrong or evil or scary that happened. Let's just have cutesy little, you know, animals with big eyes and little giggly schoolgirls, and let's all just have a good time. And that's house pretty much.
Yeah. This is going to be so niche, and it's funny, I'm not on TikTok, but I've had obviously TikTok sent to me because culture, I guess. And there's this amazing TikTok from a few years ago. If you've seen it, interrupt me, but it's like a map of Asia, and it's Japan. It's a little mouth of Japan being like talking to all the countries it colonized, which in the TikTok is like half of Asia. And the little Japanese mouth is like, guys, I'm so sorry for colonizing you. Like, I want to be friends with you now. And they're like, Japan, shut up. Like, you were so mean to us. You bullied us. You took our land, blah, blah, blah. And Japan's like, oh, come on, guys. Like, that happened a long time ago, blah, blah, blah. And the little colonized countries keep talking. And then Japan's like, but what if I bring kawaii? And then the rest of the Asian cultures are like, Japan, shut up. We're not going to fall for it. Oh, it's so pretty.
It's so true. And,
And that's Japanese culture. Yeah. And we're like, how could you be mad? They're
Yeah. It's like this. Let's paint over all the terrible, terrible thing. I mean, Japan did some of the worst atrocities, human rights atrocities that you could even imagine. But, you know, when we see the kawaii things, we're just like, oh, it doesn't matter.
It's a sense of irony that it's distinct, right?
Oh, yeah,
it's
distinct. Yeah.
Because I think it's also like a self-awareness. Mm-hmm. One thing, and we'll talk about this when we get more into the nitty-gritty of J-horror, but like for me, it was always Japanese and Korean cinema. And I'll even be a little controversial here. I think I prefer Korean cinema just a little bit mm-hmm. more. But I think because with Korean cinema, there's more of an inherent sadness. Whereas Japanese horror, there's obviously like this doom there, but I think there's almost more of an inherent irony. Like an inherent cheekiness.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's very, very nuanced because both cinemas, and I mean, they're cinemas that speak to each other. Like some of my favorite films are things like The Wailing that like directly take on this dichotomy of Japanese and Korean tensions. But yeah, so Haosu, just complete batshit. But also, so to I guess relate this to the original point of it being, you know, related to the bombings, Obayashi was born in Hiroshima and like literally was like right at ground zero. And yeah, you see that laced very subtly, but very distinctly in a film like Haosu, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, even in the house itself, which, you know, we traditionally think as a place of safety, is trying to kill them all from the inside. I didn't know he lived in Hiroshima. That's really, thank you for telling me that. That's where I used to live in Japan. I lived there for a year.
Wow.
So I wish I'd known
Have you
that.
Seen Drive My Car?
No, I'm so behind on all the like Oscar movies this year. Yeah. And I know it's going to make me cry. So I haven't yet. House is very much... everything inside the house is coming to life in this like way that, you know, it's not about radiation or anything, but it could, you know, what is making these inanimate objects act this way? We never find out, but it could be implied that, you know, there's some kind of radiation that's fucking with the DNA structure of them and is making them all crazy. But yeah, I just love it.
A very vengeful movie as well, right? Mm-hmm. It's just like these. Yeah. It's so beautiful. Kawaii and vengeance. I mean, it's like that beautiful sweet and sour. It's happiness and death, right? Technically, it's a gruesome film, but not really. It's so camp. In ways, it's very queer without being queer at all.
Oh, definitely. You know? Yeah. I mean, you have this gang of young girls and there's only one, well, there's Mr. Togo, I guess, who kind of is completely fucking useless.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they're all discovering parts of themselves and facets of themselves with this amazing, cool auntie who I fucking love auntie, by the way.
Yeah. No, she's amazing. And at the same time, like, I think there's a way to even think, like, is she the cause of it all? Like, you know, like, there are so many layers to Haosu that at its core, like, at face value, actually, it may not seem like, what is this? Like, you have no idea how many times my students are like, what did I just watch? There's nothing to interpret here. And it's like, actually, there's a lot. Many things to interpret here.
So much.
I think from my end that I wanted to point out those things. Now, when we were planning this episode, one thing that you listed that I was like, oh, I had never really heard of that before. And I was going to go do research on it, but I was like, no, I'll let Amber tell me about this. Was this idea of the lost decade, because now we're beginning to get into, so Haosu's from the 70s. Mm-hmm. But then comes the 80s and whatnot. So can you tell us a bit more about the concept of the lost decade?
Well, yeah, it's basically, I mean, coming out of the war, Japan was obviously, you know, what do they say, chopped liver for a few decades. But then come the 80s, there was this like economic boom, a lot of trade with America, you know, a lot of technology, which is a huge thing that we'll see with the later J horror, cars, computers, phones, things like that. And, you know, in the 80s, Japan was arguably its most prosperous economically. And, you know, every bubble has to pop at some point. So it was 1991 when the, you know, economic bubble kind of popped. And then, you know, what always happens is when you're so far up, you can only go so far down. So then we have this period of like economic stagnation, which is really not fully over in Japan. I mean, I don't know next to nothing about economics, but what I do know is that Japan has never really recovered from that period of in the 90s to about 2010, probably, I would say, where it was just, you know, loss of jobs. We see a lot of breakup of the nuclear family, which is another thing that comes into J-horror.
It's going to be huge. Yeah.
Massively, massive suicide spikes.
Which we also get
In so many. So,
all of this is going to pop up.
So, you know, for the what we're calling J-horror, the late 90s to 2000s, the lost decade was really arguably like one of the biggest causes for what we now see, what we now think of as classic J-horror.
We're setting the stage, but there's this really interesting thing about J-horror, right? Which absolutely the time frame that you said is typically what we consider J-horror. But there is this film from the 80s that tends to get like, but this is where we see the beginning of what's to come, right? And that's with Tetsuo.
Oh,
Tetsuo,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Tetsuo.
Yes.
I love this movie.
Yeah.
This movie is just batshit.
It is such a difficult... I mean, I think of it as like it's in my top five films of all time. It is such a difficult watch. But it is so worth it. And afterwards, I literally feel like I've been like attacked afterwards. I'm like sat there panting, like,
oh yeah. It's visceral.
It's visceral. Onslaught. Just nonstop grinding metal in your face, like screaming at you. And I fucking love it.
And it's so poetic. It's like, you know, It's like poetry, but like poetry done with a chainsaw.
Yes. Oh, I'm going to love that description. I might have to steal that from you. Sorry.
So I have a bit of context about this film, which I love what Shinya has said about this film himself, because this is going to also set the trend in like... so far, the few films that we've talked about are like very connected to Japanese culture and the backbone of their storytelling and their beliefs and whatnot. But the interesting thing about J-horror is it was all of the cultural stuff that you just set up with the Lost Decade. It's still this deep Japanese irony and the thin veil between the living and the dead. But we're getting filmmakers that are specifically influenced by the West. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what makes that's what just made it so accessible to us and so translatable in many ways. Yeah, it was foreign in a lot of ways, but I mean, Shinya himself, so this is from an interview that I watched for the pod. He said that his biggest influence, well, first off, he said Godzilla came out when he was in elementary school and he was like, his mind was blown because even that young, he could sense that everything was inspired by the hydrogen bomb. And, you know, it wasn't like someone told him about that. He said that as young, like he could see the darkness that made up Godzilla. And he was like, it was the horror of war that made the monster black, that made the monster dark. And he said that would like kickstarted something in his brain. But what influenced him more than, because essentially he gets known for being like the cyberpunk first for like creating the film that was like the cyberpunk steampunk Japanese cyberpunk icon, right? But he said other cyberpunk films didn't influence him the more than David Cronenberg.
Yes, he said the body horror.
Video, he said, Tetsuo is my love letter to Videodrome. Like, he said that the organicness of technology being so intrinsic to the human body and the soul was his driving force for Tetsuo. And I think that is, like, maybe not obvious when you first watch it, but after the fact, you're like, yeah, this is, like, Cronenberg, but, like, done at a different symphony, done in a Japanese key, right? So much so that it doesn't even become like inspired by Cronenberg, it becomes its own self. But after I heard him say that, I was like, oh shit, I get that so strongly now.
Yeah, it's this like this amalgamation of flesh and metal like together. And I feel like with Cronenberg, he's obviously the master of that, but he at least gives you a break in his films. Like there are moments of downtime. The Iron Man does not give you a second to rest. And while we're talking about the Iron Man, I have to say shout out to Kei Fujiwara, who was the she was the cinematographer on the Iron Man. She also, and she never gets enough love. So I just got to give a little bit for her here. She also created the drill phallus, which I just love that a woman created that as well.
Yeah, no, it's you know, it's a film. When I first watch it, first off, I think it's like we can call it an avant-garde film.
Oh,
like to me, that film is, as you say, just challenging. And I think one thing that I think we'll talk about maybe more in detail later is like this gender disparity, but also how gender is treated on screen. Mm-hmm. It's different. And then like Western exploitation, so to speak, but there definitely are tensions, and it wasn't until you sent me the message about Sion Sono that I found out about that stuff, and I was like, I want to talk about it later, but my point is, as you say, like the images though in and of themselves, they almost are like, They challenge the very binary of genderism in and of itself, where like Tetsuo can be read as a queer story.
Oh,
Tetsuo
100%.
Can be read as a story outside of even binary notions of human gender and whatnot. And at the very core, it is just about this fusion of technology that you can think might only come from a place like Japan that is at the forefront of such technological culture. So the Iron Man just becomes like, I love Tetsuo so much, even though I think it's almost set apart from J-horror in how highly unique it is, in my opinion.
I mean, the only film I've seen that is similar to Tetsuo is 964 Pinocchio, which is another cyberpunk film. It's about a sex robot who gets loose. But again, it's like this onslaught of like grinding metal and just constantly in your face. And that is another film that really fucks with gender in the same way that Tetsuo. I mean, Tetsuo is a gay love story. It has two men at the end who join together to create this genderless form.
Amazing.
He says, our love can destroy this whole fucking world.
Yes, like, I know. I love
gay
it.
Gay icon Tetsuo. I love it.
And the editing as you say, the cinematography I think is the key to the film, but the editing is just like, right now I'm staring off thinking about it. It's just so good.
Yeah, I feel like it's one of those movies that, I mean, for me personally, I love it, but I can't watch it more than like once a month because I'm just like, oh my god. I need to lie
once
down.
Every few years. I absolutely love it. So, you know, Tetsuo is really the one that kind of begins the trend, but we don't really get the wave until now, the time frame of like the late 90s, early 2000s. Mm. Ringu, I think, was my first, but I can't tell you like a very strong memory of, I know that I watched it, but I don't have a strong memory of it. And so when I came back to J-horror, the film at that time that was blowing everyone's minds was Battle Royale. So I always associate my reintegration with Battle Royale. And it's funny, I think Battle Royale might be considered the least horror-ish if we're talking about like supernaturalness and whatnot, but it's because it's about the horror of humanity, mm-hmm. right? And so let's talk about Battle Royale. Battle Royale is just...
I love Battle Royale. I don't know, you know, there used to be basically... Takeshi Kitano, who plays the teacher mm-hmm. in Battle Royale, he used to have this weird game show called Takeshi's...
Really?
Yeah, called Takeshi's Castle. And it's exactly what you would expect from a like stereotypical Japanese game show. There are like boulders being thrown at people. They have to jump across like rivers of lava. It is hilarious. And they used to play it on TV in the UK here on like Sunday morning. Whenever I was like, you know, eating breakfast or when I got older, whenever I was hungover after a night out, I would watch Takeshi's Castle and he would be like the ringleader. He was the presenter. And then when I watched Battle Royale, I was like, oh my God, that's Mr. Takeshi. Then I saw Battle Royale. Absolutely blew my mind. I had never seen like...
How did you see it? Do you remember?
I don't think I saw it.
Or what year?
Oh, no, I must have been... Again, this is probably the time where I just put everything together is probably my late teens, but it could have been...
Let's say 16. So Battle Royale was literally banned from distribution in the UK and in the US. And so legally... We couldn't like buy a copy. It wasn't, it mm-hmm. never was screened in theaters. So I remember how I watched it because I had heard of the controversy. And back then, obviously, there was like no Amazon or anything. So it was already sort of difficult to like go out and buy DVDs. And so I watch on AsianHorrorMovies.com.
The classic.
Back then, unless you were torrenting, which I wasn't, I did a little bit of LimeWire. Go ahead and get me feds. That's why Asian Horror Movies was like, it was a combination where it was just so easy just to go to this website, just to press play. Again, before YouTube, I was like, I'm not going to risk it with downloading stuff. I'll just watch a movie up on here. And mm-hmm. so that's how I saw Battle Royale. So I did see it, not in 2001, which is I think when it came out, I think probably around 2003, 2004. I was able to get around it that way. That's why I was curious to see how you watched it.
I don't remember. I definitely wasn't legal how I watched it.
Yeah, no. Which is amazing. Yeah, so like this is like so I mean it was just first off, this was before The Hunger Games as well. So like idea of I was that age, you mm-hmm. know, and I was like, "Whoa. This is really violent, but I love it." Like it's because, it is super violent. And the reason why, I mean, technically there's no way for countries to ban things outright. But what happens is distribution studios, in the UK and the US, distribution studios, production studios, they're scared of lawsuits. Mm-hmm. So really that was what was going on during this time. This was a little bit right after Columbine and a few other incidents in the UK. And so pretty much no distribution company wanted to touch it because they were like, this could be a lawsuit if mm-hmm. anything is repeated. And that's the core of Battle Royale, right? It's the fact mm-hmm. that it's like a it's a dystopian society. They choose a high school every year where they all have to kill each other with a surviving one, right? Or not even a high school because one of them...
The film... At the start, we see, I think it's like an elementary school maybe,
So I think it's just a school.
Yeah,
I think it's just like any school. Yeah, because you're right. That's like the iconic image of the little girl with the bloody stuffed animal, right? Yeah.
I love her.
So visceral, right? And so reason behind a lot of the controversy was just the fact that it was actual young people mm-hmm. being ruthlessly murdered, typically by each other.
It's one of those films where you can see a very specific cultural fear in it. Japan is a society where, having worked in Japanese schools, there is no fucking around there. Like, the rules are solid. You know, they still in a lot of them, they still use physical punishment. The kids clean the school after lessons are done. I mean, of course you get the little asshole kids here and there, but as for the most part, Japanese students are very well behaved and do respect the school system. So to see this downfall, this disrespect for, and it also comes back to the a lot of Japanese traditions come from Confucianism, you know, the respect of the elder, the breakdown in respect for the elder. You know, these kids, they don't care, like, they just go up to Takeshi Kitano and like stab him or something at the beginning. And I just love seeing that. I think, no, actually, I have remembered where I heard of it is because I had seen Kill Bill.
Yes, Chiaki Kuriyama. That is a big thing.
Yes.
Quentin Tarantino.
So obviously Tarantino, he like rips off so much Japanese film. But in Kill Bill, Gogo Yubari was played by Chiaki Kuriyama, who plays, I forget her name. The yellow tracksuit girl, basically, in Battle Royale.
Oh, man. Yeah, she's so awesome.
And I saw her. I was like, love her. Yeah. I also had a huge crush on Masanobu Ando, who plays the bad guy, Kiriyama. I was obsessed with like his bleached hair. I just thought he was the coolest thing ever. Just such a fucking good film. Love it.
Yeah. And a film, as you say, derived very specifically from a very specific aspect of Japanese culture, sort of pushed to the brink, but also a film that satirizes some of the kawaii culture, right?
Yes, yeah.
With the very introduction of the rules to this. I mean, it's like straight out of like a J-pop video, right? It's amazing. Or as you say, like a game show. It's very game show-like. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and then of course, like one of the lasting legacies of Battle Royale is just like look at the YA fiction genre afterward. I mean, Battle Royale itself is based on a manga, but it's very hard. You know, I know we don't need to get into the Hunger Game things here, but I think it's just clear that if it wasn't intentional, there's just so many ways that that film just seeped into the global cultural like mindset. Even though weirdly I feel like I don't hear about it talked as much anymore, and I think that's just because, you know, other Western things knocked it off and that became sort of the topic, right?
Squid Game 2 that came out, that had a very similar premise, not with kids obviously, but you know, the whole concept of killing people off until there's one winner. I don't hear it given
real
as
talk
much
that's
love
why
as
I haven't
I
still watched Squid Game, not even because I'm against it, but just because I feel like at this point I've seen it, you know?
Yeah. That's why I never watched Hunger Games. That cultural zeitgeist missed me completely because I was just like, I've seen Battle Royale.
Yeah.
So
So I watched it out of curiosity, and after you like start, it's like, well, fuck, might as well finish. But it was so dissatisfying. At the end, I was just like, wow, how soulless.
It's just not gory either. Right, it's just like boring.
It's like, I mean, Battle Royale still to this day, even though I feel like in ways it's been forgotten by a cultural memory in ways, I still think that it's just as visceral as it was back then, and I don't think anyone can touch it yet. I never saw Assassination Nation, but that seemed like something that was trying to flirt with like the tone of Battle Royale.
It's very Tumblr. I haven't seen it since.
Yeah, it seemed like
it
Tumblr
out.
Goes
it's
Battle
very Tumblr.
Royale.
Yeah.
I mean, dude ended up making Euphoria. Whatever. I still think that there's this unique magic with Battle Royale that I'm not sure anyone could ever replicate.
I wouldn't want them to try either.
Yeah. but I guess let's begin to talk about the big ones, right? So Ringu, Ju-on. Mm. Yeah. So these movies, like, what are these movies about?
So a history lesson. No. So I mean, obviously the vision of what we consider like the Japanese ghost is the vengeful female spirit.
The yurei,
the vengeful girl, the white dress, the stringy black hair. It's for a Western audience, we think, oh, the ring invented that. But no, that's like an ancient Japanese piece of folklore. I mean, to Japanese audiences, that would have been just something they'd seen before. But I remember when I first watched Ju-on. And I still consider the Ju-on franchise my favorite of all time, even though like 90% of it sucks. I had never been so scared in my entire life. I had literally never been so terrified. And it sparked this need, this drive in me to watch every Japanese horror film I could get my hands on. And I'm still finding them. And there are ones that have slipped out of my grasp after I got into Ju-on. There was this series called Tales of Terror from Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And it was on, they were all uploaded to YouTube in good quality with an English dub, English sub, sorry. And they were absolutely friggin' terrifying, just like 5-minute shorts. They are still on YouTube, but they're all in Japanese, and my Japanese is not good enough to understand it. So if anyone's listening and knows that, sorry to massively sidetrack, please get in touch with me.
No, amazing, yeah. I mean, Hideo Nakata is like the dude, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, well, his films became the most popular. To me, actually, when I think of like, who's my Japanese horror auteur, there were two answers. Takashi Miike, because like, holy fuck, all even things like Ichi the Killer, which technically I know not a horror, but to me it's a horror. I'm like,
shit's horrifying.
And Sion Sono, actually, I really Suicide Club, Strange Circus. I loved all of his films, but Hideo Nakata, I mean, I also loved all of Hideo Nakata's films, and he's the one that arguably had the most successful Western crossover, as you said, with the American remakes and whatnot. And one thing that is really interesting, you may know this, but I'll say it now. As I said with Shinyu, with David Cronenberg, Hideo Nakata said that like one of his main influences for Ringu and for his style was The Exorcist. And I think you can see that in the combination of the yurei, because she's not so... Yes, it's maybe like slower, but there's definitely a manicness to all of the versions of the yurei that he plays with. That does remind me of like Linda from The Exorcist, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a sadness there too. I mean,
yeah,
I always feel, even though Sadako and Kayako from Ju-on, even though they're evil spirits, I just feel so sorry for them. There's like a very deep sadness to their stories, which
I'm
never anti any
of these villains.
I love them. I love these girls. But you see, again, you see that in The Exorcist. You know, Reagan is a little girl.
Yeah.
She doesn't deserve what's happening to her. And even when she's spitting out the worst things you've ever heard a human say, you're just like, oh, poor baby.
Yeah, my favorite of his, I think, and I think it's Nakata, is the one, you have to help me remember the name, the one with the villain is like F, and they go down. Maribito.
Yes, Maribito. Yeah.
I think Maribito to me was like the encapsulation of like this really metaphorical drive down into the underground and into filmic worlds and into the monstrous feminine that we're talking about with this yurei figure, right? And I think that's also something that maybe should be said more explicitly here, is that this is around the time of the death of celluloid, right? But a lot of his films specifically play around with the very idea of celluloid. And this is from the country of Sony, the country of Panasonic. The object of fear itself is the materiality of film, which would somewhat make a lot, and maybe we can talk about, maybe this is why the... trend, so to speak, began to die out in the 2010s. But it would be hard to see a lot of these films properly translated in our current day with our current technology, because the materiality of the evidence, the fact that you put the videotape into the thing and you would die in 7 days.
Yeah, there's a ritual behind it.
Exactly. Or in Maribito, where there's the filming and the finding of the tapes and whatnot. To me, it also like made them scarier. Yeah. But it's also like a meta narrative as well. Yes, it's about this spiritual thing, but it's also about the very nature of the technology and the content of the technology, right?
You could never, you know, something like Ring and, you know, the mimetic nature of the distribution of the videotape, the passing on, the fear that one day it might come to you, that could never happen now because we are all exposed to the same content constantly. One of the biggest things that was scary about The Ring and also in One Missed Call is, you know, this piece of tech could come to me one day. I could be the unlucky one. But now, you know, there's no fear there because we're constantly getting things shared to us and shoved in our face without asking to see it. So no, you definitely couldn't. It wouldn't have the same effect nowadays.
Yeah, totally, totally. So Ju-on is your favorite of the crop, you would say?
Yes, and it sucks so much. So one thing I love about Ju-on is that Takashi Shimizu, who directed it, he has basically had a hand in all of them. And the timeline of Ju-on is really skewed. It goes like, the first one is called like 4-4-4-4-4. Then there's Ju-on the Curse. Then there's Ju-on the Grudge. Then there's like Ju-on the Grudge too. Anyway, it's an absolute mess. And a lot of them are so terrible. But the one that we mostly think about, the one that got the remake, is Ju-on the Grudge. And that's the one where, you know, it's got the iconic scene of Kayako cracking her way down the stairs. It introduces us to the split narrative.
As soon as you said that, I heard it.
I remember seeing that and just completely obsessed. To the point where I have tried to watch every and this is another thing with Japanese horror, right? A lot of it is very hard to come by legally, hard to come by because a lot of it doesn't get a huge distribution, English-speaking distribution. So a lot of them you can find, but they don't have subs or whatever. But anyway, I've tried to keep up with most of Ju-on, and bless him, Shimizu has kept trying, and he's never really got back that same sense of fright that he did with Ju-on the Grudge. Just a monumentally scary, and you know, so much of that film is, you are never safe, even when you think you are. Even when you get into your bed, you are not safe.
Oh, yeah. It haunts. Yeah, I remember that. That's so unique, right? Ju-on, did you ever see, I know this is going to be sacrilege, but I'm curious. Did you ever see the 2020 American version?
I tried. I really did. With Lin Shaye. I think she was
I remember the director, because you know why I ask? I loved the director's first film, which was The Eyes of My Mother. I love that movie. But I haven't seen the Grudge movie because I was like, I can't see how this would be good, though.
No, I mean, if it's the one, because there was two. There was like a TV show that came out quite recently as well, which I also haven't watched. But the 2021, I think it had Lin Shaye, I think it had John Cho.
I think it did. I think that's exactly. Let me. Yeah.
Okay.
Nicolas Pesce is the no, this one, it stars Andrea Riseborough. Oh, and Lin Shaye. No, Lin Shaye, John Cho. Okay. Andrea Riseborough is really becoming.
I like her a lot. I mean, I loved Lin Shaye. John Cho's great. I just. Maybe
so like you literally had to stop it.
I just, not that I was angry, I just didn't care. I was just God. And you know, I know a lot of people have said like, oh, the original Ju-on is so slow and nothing happens. I'm like, well,
that's not true.
It's not true. And also you have to go back to this came out, for me personally, this came out at a time where I had never seen anything this goddamn tense on screen before.
Because that's the thing. It's the tension, right?
Yeah.
That, That is one thing that I think then does become different with like Korean horror. And I think maybe that's why I leaned into it more, because especially with Park Chan-wook and Bong Joon-ho, those movies are like boom, 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 yes. boom. Mm-hmm. But the Japanese films were definitely about a little bit more about atmosphere. Again, not saying Korean horror is not about atmosphere. It absolutely is. But like there's this very slight nuance where it's like the tension, the breath, the fact that the very horror itself is lying in the shadow and not coming directly at you so quickly. Some of the films from this time that I think are a bit underrated, because I would say Battle Royale is my favorite. Takashi Miike, you know, I think there was definitely a time where Audition was just like my life, especially because I was a little baby emo. And I don't know if you know this, but My Chemical Romance, their video for not Vampires, but I'll need one of their videos from their first album, which is the album before they blew up. Not to say I'm an original My Chemical Romance fan, but it was an adaptation of Audition. Like, oh my God, this is so cool. So like that is what got me to watch Audition, which was, so it's like it all coincided right at the right time. So I have a very important spot in my heart for Audition. For
Audition rocks,
For my students are probably going to listen to this, and I make them watch Audition. It's so hard choosing one of the films, but the thing about Audition is just that it's almost everything at once. Technically not supernatural, but the very aesthetic of the yurei is transposed.
Yeah, Asami is, you know, the white, she still has the white shift gown. She still has the long, not stringy, she's got gorgeous hair, but the very long straight hair. And she's still out for vengeance. So even though she's not supernatural, she very much is still a yurei figure.
Yeah. So like, you know, so iconic. But to mention a few that typically I feel don't come up as often, but I remember watching them again back when I was a teenager and thinking like, oh my God, this is so wild. I think of things like Carved, the slit mouth woman.
Oh, yes.
I love the other one was, I love Exta. I loved, goodness, what else?
There's some really, this time you get some really, you get also Infection, which was 2004,
Suicide Club,
Suicide Club, there's one called Vampire Clay, which I think was around this time.
I already mentioned Strange Circus, So I think what I just loved about all of them, also just like, the effects work is so beautiful in these films. The Happiness of the Categories, definitely for sure. Noroi also had like this really,
That's in my top 10 favorite.
Let's maybe talk about Noroi a little bit. Because it's unique Noroi in the sense that it's found footage, right?
Yes, and mockumentary mixed together. I remember watching Noroi, and when I watched Noroi, again, it was this late teens time. It was Noroi again didn't have a release for ages in the West. So when you found it, I think I watched it on YouTube maybe.
I didn't watch it until a few years ago on Shudder. So it took a while for me.
Right. Yeah. It didn't get released like legally on streaming until I think a couple of years ago. But before that, when I found it on YouTube, and I genuinely, it was like stumbling across a genuine haunted relic. I knew it wasn't real, obviously, but a brief
the
part
quality
of, me was
of that
very
film
much,
is purposely low.
And imagine finding that. You know, it's like I used to go through these binges, like searching through YouTube, trying to find these scary films. I found it, and I was like, "Holy shit! I have found a real cursed film." And it's just absolutely terrifying. And Koji Shirashi, who directed Noroi, he also directed Carved, which you mentioned.
Yes, I love the design of Carved.
I like Carved. Yeah. I mean, Kuchisake Onna is such an iconic piece of Japanese folklore.
It's definitely,
it's
not as highbrow, I guess.
It's not very scary. I wouldn't say it's scary.
But it's just like, it's just so fun.
It is.
And in ways that's, so maybe to talk a little bit about Sion Sono, I think that's why I liked so many of his films is that they weren't necessarily scary, but they were like depraved in a way. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that was the excitement of the Japanese cinema, because I know that in that time of American horror, there was like the rise of torture porn, Eli Roth, mm-hmm. and things like that. And like, none of that was even appealing to me, but seeing these really warped, as you say, the breakup of the nuclear family, we get a lot of that in Sion Sono's filmography. Though disappointingly, recently it's come out that a lot of that he had been sexually harassing a lot of women on his mm-hmm. films. And when I read that news, I have to say, I was like, the vibe of some of his films does not make this doesn't land as a surprise. Like,
yeah, I never want to be like, oh, how did people not know? But I know that there's a very specific tension to, I think I recently watched Cold Fish, which I think he released in 2010. And that's just a really horrible experience. It's a good film, a really good film, but it's just the whole time you're like, oh,
yeah. No, and
should
so
I be seeing this?
No, and so that's something to mention too, though. And actually, one thing that is, and so I did more research after you mentioned this to me. You just started like a whole thing.
Sorry.
No, but important. No, this is so important. And yeah, I mean, it makes you, I don't know if I could, with the context now, I don't think I could watch things like Cold Fish or Strange Circus ever again, because it already made me deeply uncomfortable seeing these, the way that family is manipulated in very intimate and honestly sexual ways. It's like, that's sort of the point, like in things like Audition, you know, that's like the point of it, right? It's like the vengeance around that exploitation. And it definitely gets into questions of like, you know, well, how do we handle that then, like what, where is the line, so to speak, like when should we show concern? And I think it's very telling that a lot of the Japanese industry is just like completely ignoring the fact that these things came out, because I think there is this maybe permissibility that it's like, well, you guys wanted art, like what what do you think happens on, like there's some things are always going to bleed through a little bit, but it's for the art.
Yeah.
And I think that's definitely more acceptable, or at least more openly acceptable in Japanese culture rather than in America, where it's a lot more hypocritical and a lot more puritanical, whereas Japan's like, well.
I mean, it's this sounds really awful, but it's the fact that it's even news in Japan means it's a big deal. Japan does not have a great history of how women are treated in the workplace.
Right.
They're just now beginning to get their own kind of Me Too movement. But basically, the word feminist is a very dirty word in Japan because they have this I don't know. I don't want to get into it too much because I'm not like, I'm not qualified. But yeah, the fact that it was news in Japan, where often sexual assault and harassment in the workplace is just kind of like, glossed over.
Yeah.
It makes me really kind of think, oh God, who else are we going to hear about next? I mean, Takashi Miike is Sion Sono's like a very close friend.
That was my scary. I was just like, okay, am I gonna have to like throw out like half of my faves? But you know, if that happens, then it happens. I mean, that's what sort of makes the cinema itself so appealing and transgressive, because we appreciate the transgression because we're able to be like, wow, what a well-told story. But I mean, there are things that maybe we don't know, but I think one thing we can speak to, because I agree, I don't necessarily want to speak in the place of Japanese women or anything like that, is the lack of Japanese female filmmakers in the genre.
There's not many. When I sent that message to you about directors that I was interested in covering, and then you said, can we talk about some women too? And I was like, oh shit, there's like not a single woman on that list.
It's something that I, whenever I build my classes, I really try to look at the range of the national cinema landscape, because I know that obviously when I Google something, maybe like it's going to be the most popular result first. It's not going to tell me what is being missed here. And so I have tried to go off on my own and try to find the Japanese female filmmakers, and you found names I had never even heard of. So I appreciated that I asked you, but that's
only,
something
I
that
I thought of three off the top of my head.
Maria Sato?
Yeah, Maria Sato directed...
That's the only one that I knew of, yeah.
Yeah, she directed Ju-on Black Ghost, which is the only, really, the only reason I... And Fatal Frame, of course. But I knew her through Black Ghost, which was a segment of Ju-on. Then Kei Fujiwara, who we've spoken about, who worked on The Iron Man. She also directed a gore film called Organ. And who was the other one I met? Oh, Mika Ninagawa, who directed a film called Helter Skelter, which is horror and it's more like a psychological drama, right. But it's one of the most beautiful films I've ever seen. If you can watch it, check it out, because it's absolutely gorgeous. But yeah, I could only think of three off the top of my head, compared to, you know, the tens of hundreds
so many that we've just,
of male directors that we had just like listed off, which is it's very disappointing. But you know, that we see that in every country, basically.
No, we do. And so, you know, there's a lot of nuance here. You know, I definitely think there are very feminist aspects to a lot of J-horror, especially like when I think of like the feminist J-horror film, I typically think of things like Audition, because it is so much focused on her vengeance. Of course, there could be a reading like her vengeance is being exploited by this male gaze, which definitely fair, but I definitely do think we get... We get a more female-centric horror in and of itself when we look at Japanese horror. And I think that was part of what made it very appealing when it began being translated in American, British, European markets, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there is a huge lack of women behind the scenes in J-horror, but in front of the camera, pretty much every big J-horror film I can think of is... female-centric,
yeah,
or has
I can't
a female
think of
lead. Maybe Noroi is...
Yeah, but it's about the boy, no? And so there's like the maternal...
I mean,
yeah.
Maybe Cairo, but no, there's...
No,
yeah,
if anything, the only thing that was a sausage fest was Itchy the Killer, but I think the fact that it was a sausage fest
but
was
the
point.
Yeah, I think that was, exactly. That's a film about men being men.
Men, exactly.
Guys having fun. But
Battle Royale, like, as you say, like the main, so many women rise to the top rather than the men, right? It's like the women are hunting them down.
Yeah, and then there's the great scene where Chiaki Kuriyama's character stabs the guy in the balls, because he won't leave her alone. I mean, there's a lot of female acted violence against men as self-defense or vengeance, like you said.
Right.
And that's, again, part of what I think makes J-horror so appealing to women, is because, I want to see like a ghost rip a guy apart sometimes.
Yeah.
I just need that.
Yeah. And so I think we can... begin to, I guess, talk a bit more about one, how it began to phase out. But to me, a lot of the phase out also has to deal directly with Korea, because I think Japan set the stage. But then the Korean wave came a little, like you get A Tale of Two Sisters around 2003, 2004, 2005. That becomes the very first Korean film that gets actual theater distribution in America, which is like crazy to think about. And then you get the rise of Bong Joon-ho, right? 2006. Mm-hmm. And then you get Park Chan-wook. I mean, like, we talked about how Battle Royale was name-checked by Tarantino, but Tarantino also was like old boy, you know, and whatnot. And so I think obviously, I'm not an expert on this. This is just what I've noticed, like having taught this course for a few years, and because Asia is also not my focus. So I don't want to sound too definitive out of this. But what I feel like happened is you get this rise of the Korean genre cinema that becomes like a real threat for Japanese cinema. And we don't really get Korean remakes or anything. But I mean, especially nowadays, we just see how Korean properties just completely transfer over without the need for a remake. Mm-hmm. And
definitely.
And I think that definitely challenged a lot of this Japanese hegemony, as well as, you know, I mean, as we're saying, a lot of these films were based in the very materiality of the coming technology. But it seems as soon as everything moved to the digital sphere, where you no longer have, unless you're Tarantino, you're not really shooting on film anymore. Mm-hmm. You get this now very saturated media landscape. And I think one thing that I think definitely became a lot more popular was this huge rise in anime culture. Yeah, it was definitely there before, but I think in the 2000s, I mean, it's been like, I think post 2015 that like, I will just talk to any American, it doesn't matter the racial background, and they probably have an anime that they like, you know? And I think that that was definitely different than from when I was growing up, where anime was still, it was very popular, but it was very niche popular with certain people, you know?
Yeah, I think a few things happened at, like you said, early 2000s, we have the Korean horrors coming in. Also, Takeshi Miike in 2003 released One Missed Call, which I love One Missed Call, but it is not a good film.
No, it's not. I won't even say that I love it. I'm like,
I love it. I love it because it was one of my first. But going back, I'm like, God, this film is just trying so hard. But yeah, that was kind of like the death knell. And then after that, you just get like trying to bring Sadako versus Kayako. Like, no one cares.
Yeah, you get like these really weird.
So terrible.
I was just like, really? This is what we're doing?
So it almost begins to like... It's just this refusal to evolve.
Yeah, like, it shot itself in its foot a little bit.
And then Korea kind of
took over because they had really interesting stories coming out of there.
Yes. And they focused a lot less on supernatural horrors and more like human, like, you know, the Vengeance trilogy, the evil of mankind. And I also feel like the West can only handle one Asian country
honestly, at a time.
That, you know that meme of like Toy Story of like Andy throwing Woody in the bin?
No,
he's like, I don't want to play with you anymore. And it's like after the 80s and 90s and then the 2000s come and everyone's like, I don't want to play with Japan anymore. No. I want to play with Korea. And we're still in that, but I feel like Korea is about to be thrown away and, you know, the next Asian country will be like the thing. I reckon it's going to be Indonesia. That's my prediction.
Indonesia is, but you know, I gotta say, so during this time, and Indonesia has really been showing up lately, but I remember another country I really loved during this time was Thai cinema.
Yes,
to me,
yes.
It was like, if I wanted to be tense, I would go to Japan. If I wanted to get like this cultural, because I feel like the Korean films also are like epics. Like A Tale of Two Sisters.
So
no, yeah, that's it. A Tale of Two Sisters is just like this... To me, it's obviously a horror, and I remember it scared me, but I think when I watch it now, I just cry through the whole thing because it's just
it's
like,
amazing.
It's so...
It's like Shakespearean in its level.
It's so Shakespearean. Like, so whenever I wanted something that I felt like would be a bit more of an epic and more based in like history, I would go to Korea. But if I just wanted like batshit... Just like no whole, like no bars on anything. I would go to the Thai cinema. And I still think Thai cinema was transgressive in grosser ways than even Japanese or Korean cinema were. Because it was almost like an onslaught, you know, Old Boy and things. Yeah, gross things happen throughout, but it builds and builds and builds. And that's the point. But Thai cinema was just like, yeah, we're just gonna do whatever the fuck we want.
Yeah, I need to expand my time. I mean, I only really know of, you know, Shutter, of course. Everyone knows Shutter. And Shutter is kind of, I love Shutter, but it is kind of a J-horror, like, not rip-off, but it's very influenced. But then recently, The Medium blew me out of the water.
Yeah.
And you can definitely also see, because that was written by Na Hong-jin, who wrote The Wailing. You can feel the Korean style.
Oh, yeah, you can. Yeah.
It's like 5 hours long.
Yeah, no. It is. It's a build, but yeah, I mean, God, the reeling is 3 hours long, but every minute is worth it. Mainly because there's like four different, there's like five different acts in the whaling. No, if you want a suggestion, the one that sticks out to me is Sick Nurses. You ever saw Sick Nurses?
I've got Sick Nurses on my list. Oh, and my God. I've been looking for it.
To this day, I haven't seen it in a very long time, but I can still remember a lot of the gore from it.
And okay, I'm gonna bump that up.
Yeah, so Sick Nurses is just, it was to me one of the most creative gore fests of that time.
Even the name sounds amazing. Sick Nurses. I love that.
No, as you say, I think that is very, I think low key, I always thought that too. I was like, yeah, it seems like the West could only handle one at a time. Though I have to say, like, the Korean wave is, like, Squid Game was a bit of a surprise to me because, again, it didn't seem all too remarkable in the grand scope of all that I know about Korean genre, but I could see why people would be interested in it.
We're at that time now where if you put Korean so-and-so in front of it, people are going to like. And I have lived in Japan and Korea, and both countries are very, very dear to my heart and create amazing art, but I think a lot of the time, in the West, if you just put, oh, it's from Korea, people are more inclined to see it positively, even if it isn't that great. I mean, and that's hard to say because most of the stuff that makes it to the West from Korea is pretty great.
I've said this on the podcast before. I don't care, but I think it blows my mind that Parasite is what did it. I'm like, really? Really? Like, I mean,
of all the films of Bong Joon-ho, I mean, I love Parasite, but Bong Joon-ho just probably got
Like, even things like Akia, I'm like, there's so much digging in here. Snowpiercer, to me, even The Host, goddamn, The Host is just like, it's simple overall, but there's so much going on. So like when I saw Parasite, I didn't hate it, obviously, but I was like, yeah, this seems like your Hitchcock film. Like, I got it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the way that the West, and so it's weird. It's interesting. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but there's a Snowpiercer series remake here.
I've heard of it. Yeah.
I tried to be honest. I could not make it through.
I don't really like the film that much.
I mean, overall, it's like, no, yeah, totally. So right now, when we talk about J-horror, it's still very much in a past time sense. Now, I do want to give a shout out to one film that I saw somewhat recently that I thought I was like, this is so much fun. And a lot of people sometimes give me shit for it because they don't think it's a real horror, but I still count it. But it's One Cut from the Dead. I think What Cut from the Dead is,
I still haven't seen that. It's still on my list. Am I a terrible person?
Wait, what? You haven't seen What Cut from the Dead?
I can't talk
about it then. Okay, never mind.
Sorry.
No. Only because if I talk about it, I'm going to spoil it. So I think that's the last one that I've seen that I really liked. You know, I'm always looking to. I think one thing, I mean, recently we've been having, you know, I always forget, I don't want to say his name, but the director of Drive My Car is having a bit of a moment right now in the West,
Ryusuke so-and-so.
Okay.
I can't pronounce it. Sorry.
Again, beautiful. That's why I don't want to say it. I'm like, I love you, but yeah. That's cool. I still have a lot of hope for Japan because honestly, I mean, the culture's still there. The filmmakers are still there. It's nowhere near that. Japanese still has a pretty large hegemony in a lot of spaces, you know. But it does seem like there is no coalition, so to speak, about like what is the identity of the horror community there. I feel maybe
I would like to see them be a bit braver.
Yeah,
I mean, like we mentioned, we kind of get, you know, we still get this rehashing of Sadako versus Kayako, but then I've been trying to push myself with gore recently.
Interesting.
I've been getting into like the Guinea Pig series, which was a series of films in the 90s in Japan, which Charlie Sheen called the FBI because he thought one of them was a snuff film. and films like Tumbling Doll of Flesh, which is a group. Grotesquely violent porn film, basically, which has a lot of limb hacking. But those films, as absolutely gruesome, gross as they were, there was a bravery to them. There was like a pushing of boundaries. that I haven't seen for a while, and I would love to see some filmmakers from Japan kind of, you know, okay, let's forget the Yuri image for a while, because that's had its day. We've got our icons, we've got Kayako, yeah. we've got Sadako. Let's try something new. And I haven't seen One Cut of the Dead, but I've got that on my list because I've heard good things about it. So yeah, I would like to see a bit more.
So what I was going to say about what from What Cut from the Dead is that I think why I liked it so much is it felt so different. And and I don't think this is a spoiler. It's very meta. And I'm like, I feel like no other country has enough wit and insight. Again, this irony thing, mm-hmm. it really takes this irony thing to another level. And I really don't want to say anything, but you just have to watch it blind. You cannot, do not look up anything about it because,
okay, I won't.
Because that's how every, like, yeah, they're just, yeah, I can't talk too much about it, but yeah, its form in and of itself is so mm-hmm. fresh overall. And I think, and I mean, it has the really amazing thing about it is it was made for $28,000, something like that.
Wow.
And it is officially the highest grossing and like profit margin film from Japan, just because the budget was so low, but it made like millions of dollars.
Oh, that's so cool.
One thing that to talk about, I guess, where I do see like Japanese genre nowadays is I see a lot of appropriation from the West recently. Like there's this new show called Tokyo Vice on HBO Max. I think the new David Leitch film is also set in Japan on a train. It's in Japan or Korea. I think it's Japan. But everyone in it is a Western actor. So definitely there's still a lot of, I guess, transnationalism going on here. But I agree with you. I wish that Japanese filmmakers held the forefront of their own rather than seeing mm-hmm. a lot of these genre stories sort of move east and whatnot.
Yeah, it's almost this fear to try something new. So I think maybe there's this thought of like, well, we made the J-horror thing and that's our thing. And we're just going to keep doing that over and over again. It was like, well, at some point you have to move on because obviously the J-horror thing isn't working anymore.
Yeah.
The lightning in a bottle has gone for whatever reason. You know, we're out of that tech fear place now.
Right.
We could take the technophobia and maybe do something else with it. But I don't think we need to go back to, you know, our Yure image. Let's try another kind of yokai. Let's try one of the other weird
they
guys.
They have so many. Yeah. in many ways, I'm about to put something even sacrilegious out there, but it would even be interesting to see how like something like Onibaba could be remade in a more modern context, because I feel like, again, you have so much so much history with, God, how many imperial periods that they have, you know, not that mm-hmm. everything needs to go to
so
the
much.
Past, but like there are a lot of ways. And you know what? I'm sure that they're out there, because one thing that we have working against us is that we can't go research in Japanese. Right. And, and so we always have to be mindful, as much as we're complaining right now. One thing that I want to give credit to is that there are probably independent Japanese filmmakers pushing these boundaries out there. And this is why distribution networks need to be made more accessible, mm-hmm. because we only gain when we learn through stories like that.
I reviewed the short films of the Final Girls Film Fest Berlin, and there was an amazing film called Visitors, mm-hmm. which was like a kind of a Japanese Evil Dead type thing, and it was just so fun. It was just so gory and so hilarious, and it just blew my mind. And
amazing.
So yeah, these films are out there. We just unfortunately we don't get to see them because, like you said, if you're not fluent in Japanese, it's hard to search for these things. You obviously can't watch it without an English dub. Suicide Forest Village came out not too recently. by Takashi Shimizu. Again, that was just kind of a disappointment for me because it was like, oh, we're trying to go back to this like this kind of gloomy suicide place. But then Visitors was just like fun and gory and just like a blood fest. I was like, this is what I wanted, something fresh and new.
I think you're gonna love What Comes from the Dead. I really you keep mentioning, I'm like, man, you really need to watch it. I think you said it exactly well. And actually, you know, huge shout out to Final Girls Film Festival overall, you know, because I think that is what that is how we do, we are able to see international films that are left out of mainstream conversations. I mean, we see how many people are left out of the mainstream. It's just a matter of getting venues like Final Girls Film Festival, which take their mission very seriously about, you know, representing the underrepresented voices. And even, you know, we can argue that Japanese horror is not underrepresented, so to speak, but I mean, more modern voices are. And either way, you know, everyone deserves to have these platforms of accessibility that mainstream horror economies honestly leave out all the time. That's sort of the annoying thing. And we both love horror, but we also pay a lot of attention to the independent scene because that is really where true newness is coming out, right?
Yes. Yeah. I would love to stop seeing all the remakes and reboots of the Halloweens and Screams, and maybe we could give the money to some. But that's a different topic for a different time, and one that's not going to make me very popular.
I say this all the time, actually. People will be like, yeah, go watch this. And I'm like, I hated all the movies that you made me see in theaters, but I loved all the movies that I saw over at Final Girls Film Festival, which, by the way, I know that we're beginning to come to our close, so I don't feel too bad going a little off topic. I just saw your post on You Are Not My Mother. I saw that at Final Girls Film Festival. And yeah, it was one of those movies where I was like, where can everyone see this right now? This movie needs to be playing everywhere.
Yes. Yeah. It is. I have, after I posted that, I had more so than ever before anything I've reviewed, I had people messaging me like, where can I watch this? Where can I watch this? I was like, well, it's out digitally now. And yeah, it needs to be seen because it's just, like I said in my post, it's the first film in years to give me a nightmare. Yeah. Like, I have not been that creeped out in a long time. And that's what I needed, honestly.
And it's, you know, at the end of the day, I don't even think that the story itself is all too new, so to speak, but it's done, it's dressed in its own cultural makeup and to a very specific perspective that it does feel new. Like at the end of the day, we can break down the breakdown of that storyline and see how it follows other storylines, but it's the very execution itself that elevates it to something that I haven't seen in a very long time that just has a spirit within it that is scary. It's sad. And to me, there's also this very underlying intimacy just in how the film is directed and in how all the characters interact with each other, where it's just like well acted. And sometimes...
Oh, the acting is unbelievable.
Sometimes you just need like perfect chemistry among all of your characters to really achieve a higher level of execution in a genre film where you're really trying to evoke certain reactions out of the audience, right? And I think You Are Not My Mother, again, I probably never would have seen it without Final Girls Film Festival, and then me trying to find it and then even convincing myself to watch it, like, oh yeah, but all of these other movies. And so like I think that the final thought there is like, support independent film festivals. We're huge fans of them because some of the best stuff that we watch, as you said, like the Japanese short that you saw, tends to be so there good. And it's so unpredictable with distribution, which is the really sad part sometimes about these things.
Yeah. And honestly, like I would say as well, jump at any chance you can to watch an indie feature. There's so many good ones for free on YouTube. And even like I have done this a couple of times, is I've emailed the director and just be like, hey, I'd love to see your film. Can you point me? And, you know, I'll pay you. And a lot of directors are just happy to get their film seen because at the end of the day, when you've put all your love and all your money, these are people who haven't got the huge Hollywood budget. and or connections.
Don't understand that, yeah, anyone can make a film now. It's all about how are people mm-hmm. going to see it. Even if you put it up yourself on YouTube, exactly. how are you going to convince people not to just flip on Netflix? It's yeah. there's so many barriers. I cannot have said what you just said better.
Yeah, I think it's important for us to do I always try to, if I've reviewed something by an indie creator, I always try and tag them yeah. in it. And because I want them to know that their work is being seen yeah. and being loved. And yeah, just if you can, guys, just do that. Yeah. If you've seen an indie feature that you like, just give the creator yeah. some love. Tag them on Twitter and let them know.
Tell people, because honestly, whenever you post things that I already was thinking about or I had already seen, I'm like, yes, there's my affirmation. And really that's how community is built. And I think that's something that we both deeply believe in, and we both are doing it in very different ways, but it's so awesome to like come together to do something like this with you and to talk yes. about a subgenre Absolutely. That clearly, I mean, it changed the world, right? Mm-hmm. But it's also very personal for us in different ways, and it just really shows the power of shaping taste, shaping perspective. There are so many times that I have seen so many different films. Like I recently saw Uma.
I never got to see it. Is it good?
Okay. What I was going to say was that I could appreciate what it was doing, but my first thought after that mm-hmm. was like, well, what a neat little remake of a Japanese style Korean story done from a Korean American mm-hmm. perspective. And I don't want to be dismissive because I hadn't seen a film that tackled that exact topic, but it just felt like the aesthetics itself were a little tiring. And I think that's also why it hasn't really taken off, because I'm sure some people, again, I wouldn't say it's bad. I wouldn't say I didn't like mm-hmm. I didn't like or I didn't dislike it. It was very mid. It was just like, yes, this is well done. And I've seen it in some way before.
Okay. I'll watch it, but I reserve my judgment then.
I mean, I think some part of me wonders if most of the charm for me wasn't built out of just the fact that I love Sandra Oh and I wanted to like it. So mm-hmm. I was like, okay, Sandra Oh.
Yeah.
And I mean, come on, Sandra Oh doing a genre film. Like, that's fun.
Yes, that's so exciting, yeah.
So yeah, I forgot what that thought was tied to. I got to thank you so much for doing this with me, because I really had so much fun. And I think your excitement, our excitement, our knowledge really makes this an interesting dive into such an influential genre, right?
Thank you. Yes. Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for bringing your own passion. And I'm just so excited to speak to someone who also is so like,
it like, was a weird time, wasn't about it? Japanese I, this is a real story. I don't really talk to my family anymore, but I was into Japanese horror when I was a teenager, when I was living with them. And one time I took one film class in high school, and it's what made me decide like, yes, film was my life. And so I had to do a presentation, and it was a presentation on my favorite movies of the time, and it was Japanese horror. So I did, I don't even know what I did is, it was like Windows Media Maker. It wasn't even like a proper editing software. And I was like ripping video trailers off of YouTube and very primitively, like just cutting sections of the trailers together. And then I created like a 5-minute little Japanese horror supercut. And my biological father found it. And he played it and he was like, this is the sickest shit I've ever seen. What the fuck are you doing? Like, did you get that? And I'm just like, yeah. I mean, I guess back then it was like, 15? I guess in ways, if you had no context. And again, I chose like the most visceral of the visceral of Japanese.
Like the vomit scene from Audition.
Yeah, sawing limbs, the car.
Oh,
like,
nice.
I really wanted, I was an emo. I was like, yes, I'm edgy too. So I think after after having that experience so young, there's a certain bond that comes across with people that, yeah, we just, we get it, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree.